Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
From the Latin de Grand University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the closing market report for the fourth day of April 2016. I'm Todd Gleason out of the office today, so no update of the commodity markets. However, we've got a really great program for you. We'll start off with Brian Young, who's a weed scientist at Purdue. He made a presentation at the All Day Agricultural Outlook about the do's and don'ts of herbicide protection for your fields this year, especially for soybeans. You'll want to pay attention, and then I've got a little update about what's happening with dicamba and US EPA. I'll tell you this, that it's not legal yet, and the comment period for dicamba opened April 1st, that would have been last Friday, and it closes not until April the 30th. So we'll go through all of that today on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Just a reminder that I'm out of the office, so the numbers you're about to hear have nothing to do with the trade in Chicago on this Monday afternoon, but I thought I'd give you the monthly and the quarterly changes since we closed out the month of March last week. May contract finished down 5.5 cents in the corn for the month, down 13 for the quarter. December corn was down 5 cents, or rather half of a cent for the month, and 14 and three quarters of a cent for the quarter. May beans, 49 and three quarters of a cent higher in the month of March. The quarterly change was up 41 and a quarter cents. The monthly change for the November beans up 41 and a quarter. That's your new crop on the month of March. Again, up 41 and a quarter cent gain last month. Up 24 and a quarter cents for the change in the rolling 3 months, or the first 3 months of the calendar year. Soft red winter wheat, July contract up 20 cents last month in March and down 3 cents for the quarter. The hard red up 18 and three quarters of a cent, but down 2.5 cents for the quarter. Live cattle futures were $4 and a nickel lower on the month. They were down $5.05 on the quarter. Feeder cattle down $2 on the month, down $6.45 on the quarter. And lean hogs finished $1.62.5 lower last month for the month of March. However, up $2.40 since the beginning of the year. That's a look at the quarterly and the monthly changes in Chicago. Again, I'm out of the office, so the numbers you just heard have nothing to do with the trade in Chicago on this Monday afternoon, the fourth day of April. When we come back, we'll take a look at the do's and don'ts of herbicide application for this year. That with Brian Young from Purdue.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Our term of the day is hedge as it relates to agricultural commodity price hedging. A typical hedger might be a commercial farmer, so the market value of wheat, for instance, and other crops fluctuates constantly as supply and demand for them vary, with occasional large moves in either direction. Based on current prices and forecast levels at harvest time, the farmer might decide that planting wheat, for instance, is a good idea one season, but the forecast prices are only that, forecast. Once the farmer plants wheat, he's committed to it for the entire season. If the actual price of wheat greatly rises between planting and harvest, the farmer stands to make a lot of unexpected money. But if the actual price drops by harvest time, he could be ruined. If at planting time the farmer sells a number of wheat futures contracts equivalent to his anticipated crop size, he effectively locks in the price of wheat at that time. The contract is an agreement to deliver a certain number of bushels of wheat to a specified place on a certain date in the future for a certain fixed price. The farmer has hedged his exposure to wheat prices. He no longer cares whether the current price rises or falls because he is guaranteed a price by the contract. He no longer needs to worry about being ruined by a low wheat price at harvest time, but he also gives up the chance at making extra money from a high wheat price at harvest time. However, in the case of a farmer, it must be noted that the hedge introduces another kind of risk. If the farmer has contracted to sell all his expected crop, but then has a bad year, for instance, a year with lower than expected yields, such that his farm is not able to produce the committed quantity, he may have to purchase replacement crop at a disadvantageous price to fulfill his futures contract. And that's our trading term for the day, hedge, as it relates to agricultural commodities.
Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media on this Monday afternoon, the 4th day of April. I'm out of the office, so no update of the commodity markets or analysis for the day. However, we do have some really great programming coming up for you. Don't forget that you can visit our website at willag.org. That's willag.org. You'll find all of our programming there. You can listen to it anytime that you'd like.
This stock and commodity report is made possible with support of the Friends of WILL and Bates Commodities in Normal. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
On the second Tuesday of the month of March, we held our annual all-day agricultural outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. One of the presentations for the day was made by weed scientist Brian Young from Purdue. We asked that he make a presentation on the do's and don'ts of weed control herbicide applications for the growing season 2016 as it relates to cost savings measures. Here's his presentation.
So just to start out, I think we need to get on the same page in terms of the reality of weed control the last several years. We probably agree that's not getting any easier, correct? It's getting worse. Okay, I tried to put a positive spin on it in some ways, but yeah, it's getting worse. Weed management's getting worse because of the weeds we're facing and the herbicide resistance that they have, right? It's getting very difficult to find growers these days, especially in this geography, let's say 100-mile radius from here, where they're pretty confident that their post-emergence herbicide in soybeans is actually going to kill anything because we have resistance in water hemp to glyphosate or Roundup. We have resistance in that same water hemp plant to Flexstar, Cobra, Blazer, what we call PPO resistance. So when we lack the confidence to control any weeds post-emergence in a Roundup Ready system, it's hard to manage your costs, isn't it? Because you're pretty much married to soil residual herbicides, and you know, then we go to the saying, the best weed is one that never comes up, right? And that's what you have to do. If you have water hemp, or you know, we might even have some palm or amaranth in the geography, of course, that we can't control with post-emergence herbicides in a Roundup Ready system. And is that going to get any better? No, it's going to continue to get worse, because those who haven't had resistance in the past are commonly finding out, well, maybe they had a hint of it, and then they get more of it the next year, and then more of it the following year. And so we're not doing anything to stop it, because very few of you have stopped using glyphosate, I'm guessing. Now, there's maybe a small portion of you that might have said, well, I saw the light and I went to Liberty Link, probably because you had to, right? Because glyphosate stopped working and that was the cheapest route to go. And so we have seen a shift towards the Liberty Link system when post-emergence herbicides in Roundup Ready soybeans wouldn't work anymore. So that shift varies. And I was at a meeting last night and this morning with some other weed scientists throughout the North Central geography. In Missouri, they're using about 40% Liberty Link soybeans on their acres. Indiana, Illinois, we don't have good numbers. You know, we might say maybe in that 5 to 10% range, Liberty Link. Emerson, you're agreeing, so that's good. Emerson's agreeing with me, maybe not any of you today, but at least me. So, you know, we're seeing a shift. Now, the thing to be careful of is when you have confidence in that Liberty working, you know, the tendency is, well, let's go ahead and reduce my herbicide bill. Liberty works post, so I'm going to manage it the same way I did my Roundup 10 years ago or 15 years ago. I'm going to spray it, and I'm going to spray it when weeds are big, because that's going to hopefully reduce how much of the weed emergence might occur after I spray that post-application of Liberty. So in other words, spraying big weeds with Liberty and not using other herbicides around it. That's my biggest concern, biggest scare. Now, can you make money in 2016 if you just do that once? Well, maybe. Maybe. Price of Liberty's gone down a little bit. You don't get the seed rebate on Liberty Link beans anymore, at least from some seed dealers. And they're offering a herbicide rebate of about $8 per gallon. And that doesn't translate to a huge savings, you know, on a per acre basis, frankly. So that system, if anything, got more expensive from last year to this year. But the good news is generics. So when I talk about generics, I'm not saying that all herbicides that don't come from the major companies like, let's say, Monsanto and Syngenta and Dow and Valent or whatever, any product comes from a company not named those, they're all good and they're just fine and dandy. I'm not saying that. You have to be selective. But certainly, you have the experience that generic glyphosate or Roundup works probably just as good as other stuff, right? Most of the time, at least. Maybe a little bit of that brown stuff at the bottom of the mini bulk or something when you're done. But that's okay. So there are some generic herbicides that you can cut your bill and I think work well. The only caution is something I don't control. And that's all these marketing programs that tie you in. Well, you have to buy our herbicide and our seed to get these other rebates. So then the cost of the herbicide itself has to be factored in with that tie-in rebate program. And that's what I don't know. That's not as visible to me because it depends on how many acres you're getting in that program. How many gallons of herbicide you might be buying. So that's where it's difficult for me to say that generics are going to be cheaper. Can that happen? Absolutely. I hate to tout anything, but I can go to Rural King and build a weed control program. They have generics there. They have some that work. They're going to work just as good as some of the name brand stuff. But again, it's all about how you do your business, right? Because there's value in going and buying your chemistry and maybe your seed and maybe your fertilizer, one-stop shopping with the retailer because maybe there's an overall discount that you might realize more so than what you get at Rural King. So again, my message is you can have a cost savings with generics, but you have to be cautious of two things. One, that you're not actually losing money because all the incentives that might be tied in with the other stuff from the main manufacturers. And number two is a generic just doesn't mean that it's just a name that you haven't heard before, okay? Because a true generic is something that's the same active ingredient, period. Now, there are some low-cost herbicides out there that aren't worth a hoot because they're different combinations of active ingredients, typically the cheap ones, you might say, and they're not worth anything. You know, I would pay you not to apply some of these herbicides. They're just that bad. You don't need to be using those. But at the same time, instead of spending $20 an acre, if I knew your acre and your weeds, we might be able to get by with $15. Okay? And if you're interested in reducing your herbicide bill, which most people are, that's when it's not necessarily the amount of product that you buy, the number of dollars per acre that you purchase for your herbicides. It's how you use them or when you use them. So I can easily tell you that you can spend $20 an acre on your residual weed control program, but if you do that in a water hemp infested area and it's 2 weeks ahead of planting when you apply that residual herbicide, maybe with a burn down, well, by the time June 1st comes around, you're going to give about the same amount of weed control as roughly, you know, it could say about $15 worth of a herbicide applied right at planting. So by applying some of these herbicides earlier than what the water hemp's coming up, you're essentially wasting money. So you'd be better off just by timing that residual herbicide at the right time, okay? Does that make sense? And that's also true for the post-emergence herbicides. The most costly herbicide application is the one where you're doing a rescue treatment, right? You failed for the year. You know, you're throwing up your arms. You're saying, what can I do? And it's going to be expensive from two different standpoints. One, chances are it might not be a guaranteed program anymore because when we had herbicide resistance, especially glyphosate resistance, it's tough to find a guaranteed program in soybean. And number two is you might have yield loss because you have weeds in your crop, right? So probably the best information I can give you in terms of a do is, well, maybe it's more of a do not, is do not manage your herbicide, your weed control this year if there's a risk that you might fail and have to apply a rescue treatment because it's that rescue treatment that's the worst case scenario that kills your bottom line because that's $30 an acre, sometimes $30 an acre, and you still don't control your weeds because you might be spraying the same herbicide that you failed with 3 weeks prior, okay? So I think that's where we can make some inroads is just keep that mindset. How do I make sure I'm not going to fail with my post herbicides? So if you look at a lot of the research throughout the Midwest and even the South, you probably want to know about return on investment. And I got to be careful. There's an economist here. But the best return on investment has typically been early season weed management, where we fail with no-till burndown, mare's tail, giant ragweed, lamb's quarters. Typically, it's we don't get a clean field to start, so we're not starting clean. So we're trying to kill mare's tail after the beans are up. And then, you know, if you're not in Liberty Link, it gets expensive and probably not consistent for a cleanup treatment. So the other thing we think about is that residual. And I go back to, you know, just water hemp being a great example. If we don't get early season residual control, that means we're betting the bank that we can kill it post-emergence. I'm not confident in this geography that that can be done. And when I say geography, I guess I'm saying the Midwest. So it's not just here, but there is an awful lot of glyphosate and PPO-resistant water hemp that we've been getting calls on, and Aaron Hager's been getting calls on in this general area. You know where the worst amount of herbicide-resistant water hemp is in the state of Indiana? Any portion that touches Illinois. So, and I didn't bring it over from Illinois either. It's just coming. Maybe you brought it today. So there's been a lot of interest in new soybean traits in Enlist from Dow, which is 2,4-D resistant soybeans. Then you have the dicamba beans, which is going to be called the Xtend system. And, you know, we have commercial, we have import approval to China for those Xtend soybeans, and they're available. So for our research purposes, I went ahead and bought some at Purdue to do our research on. But there's one missing point there is I wouldn't be buying those soybeans expecting you're going to make a huge reduction in your weed control costs. You know, yields, that's Emerson's ball game there if he says that they can yield. But reducing your costs for this year, not just no, but if I could swear, I'd say heck no, right? Because right now we have no herbicide called dicamba that you can apply on those beans. It's not legal to do so. So if we're looking at legal ways to reduce your herbicide bill, applying dicamba would not be one of those at this point. So I wouldn't bank on it. EPA is dragging their feet, and they're dragging their feet, and they don't seem to be picking them up anytime soon. So right now, we don't have confidence we can spray dicamba. So if that was an effort to maybe reduce your herbicide bill for 2016, I wouldn't bank on it. I wouldn't count on it. I don't think that's going to happen. Future years, though, I know we're talking about making money this year, but future years, you know what? These companies know exactly what the value is of their soybean traits and their chemistry. So if they're not going to get the money out of you from your herbicide expenditures, in other words, that dicamba you're going to buy, bet you they're going to see it in the seed revenue, right? One way or another, they're going to realize what situation you're in, and they're going to extract that value, as they say. So don't expect to have a reduced herbicide bill if you go to some of these new soybean traits moving forward. I know that's depressing. The only way you might see a reduction in costs there is if you start to abuse the system and use 2,4-D and dicamba or Liberty as your only post-emergence herbicide, no residuals, and you just spray big weeds and hope it works until you retire.
That's Brian Young, weed scientist from Purdue Extension, joined us at the All Day Agricultural Outlook at the Beef House in Covington, Indiana. We recorded his presentation, and you heard the bulk of it. Just a note about dicamba, the EPA is making available for a 30-day public comment period right now a proposed regulatory decision to register dicamba for use in controlling weeds on genetically engineered dicamba-tolerant cotton and soybeans. The public comment on the EPA's proposed regulatory decision must be submitted no later than April the 30th. You can do that online at www.regulations.gov. After the comment period closes, EPA will review all the comments and reach a final decision. The agency expects this issue to be resolved in late summer or early fall, so no expectation for this spring that you'll be able to use dicamba on dicamba-tolerant soybeans, or cotton for that matter.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois. For 100 years, offering financial products and services specifically for the agricultural industry, including farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing, as well as farm cash management solutions.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason out of the office today. Let's step back to last Thursday in the United States Department of Agriculture's Prospective Plantings Report. I talked to Daryl Good not long after that report was released. It, of course, showed that farmers are expecting to plant a whole lot more acres than anybody ever thought they would for this growing season. I asked Daryl Good to put that in perspective as to a normal growing season and what it might mean for total crop size and price.
I think if we have a trend yield, which we calculate to be around 166 bushels per acre, we would be looking at year-ending stocks over 2 billion bushels and probably an average price. We're thinking around $3.40 a bushel next year, a full 20 cents below what we think we will average for the current year.
And USDA's trend yield is larger than your trend yield.
USDA's calculation is a couple bushels higher than ours, so if you use that, it would point to even larger stocks, depending, of course, on how strong demand is next year. I think the real question is, will we see actual acreage deviate very much from intentions? We know historically acreage does never equal March intentions. It's always a bit higher, a bit lower, with some tendency to be lower. And one might guess with the price reaction that we're seeing, depending on spring weather, we might see some of the intended corn acreage switch back yet to other crops. I wouldn't be surprised to see acreage come in eventually a million acres less than intentions. And then, of course, you still have the yield question in front of us. Yields can be above or below trend. We kind of argue that perhaps there's an elevated risk of yields below trend this year because of the unwinding of the El Nino episode. So if you had a combination of a million fewer acres and 4 or 5 bushels lower yield, you would actually see ending stocks next year not much different than this year, and an average price about the same, $3.65 or so. So I think that's the positive spin you can put on this. I don't want to yet consider the other alternative, is that we find more corn acres and an above trend yield, then things get, I think, really a bit ugly on the price side.
Nonetheless, you normally would say normal year, normal yields, that's where you start, and it turns ugly fast.
Yeah, normal yields is where you start your expectations, and then we'll see how the planting and growing season unfolds, whether those expectations should be revised and in which direction they should be revised. So still a lot of uncertainty ahead, but we're not starting with a very optimistic picture on corn prices for the upcoming marketing year.
You have said since last fall, reward the rallies. I suspect you're still saying if you have either crop, reward the rallies.
Yeah, if we get rallies, that would be the thing to do. I think, the real question now is, are we going to get some kind of information that would rally the market? And that's going to have to be primarily on the supply side. So at this juncture, we're looking for some kind of weather market to give us a better opportunity.
Daryl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Todd.
Daryl Good, agricultural economist from the University of Illinois. I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated, headquartered in Lafayette, Indiana, with branches in Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois, providing independent commodity, financial, and currency analysis to its clients and newsletter subscribers. On the web at myrmconline.com.
It's National Cordon Bleu Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1828, Casparus van Woolden of Amsterdam patented chocolate milk powder. In 1871, Mary Florence Potts of Ottumwa, Iowa, patented the Mrs. Potts sad iron. It featured a detachable handle so several iron bodies could be heated and used in turn as one cooled down. 3 irons, 1 handle, and 1 stand were sold as a set. In 1883, Peter Cooper died. Cooper obtained the first American patent for the manufacture of gelatin. In 1895, a cough syrup manufacturer, Pearlby Waite, purchased the patent and developed a packaged gelatin dessert. Waite's wife May named it Jell-O. In 1887, William Cumming Rose was born. An American biochemist, he spent a decade researching human diet. His research established the importance of 8 essential amino acids in human nutrition. And in 1932, vitamin C was isolated by C.G. King at the University of Pittsburgh. After 5 years of work on untold thousands of lemons, King and his colleagues isolated a crystalline substance identified as vitamin C. King was given a patent for his isolation process, but he was denied a patent for the vitamin itself since it was a known substance that had been isolated by a different method 3 years earlier. And that's This Day in Agricultural History.
For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason. The United States Department of Agriculture has been moving to support local food production throughout the nation. The agency is focusing on bringing new farmers and businesses into rural and urban areas. To that end, it has developed an online toolkit entrepreneurs can use to help pitch their ideas to lenders and local governments. The Local Food System Toolkit was developed by the Agricultural Marketing Service, or AMS, with Colorado State University. It's supposed to help communities reliably evaluate the economic impact of investing in local and regional food systems, says Chief of Staff for AMS, Sarah Eckhouse.
The point is to really understand what the economic impact of various investments in local food are and how they are contributing to economies and communities, creating jobs, and bolstering the economy. You know, if you want to know what the best thing to do is to make your community stronger and successful economically, you need to understand how these different investments are going to affect that the jobs or the industry. And we see local food as a real driver of economic growth. That's why it's one of the Secretary's pillars for economic revitalization in rural communities.
The Secretary is United States Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. He is, as head of USDA, a cabinet-level member of the presidential administration. In this case, that's Barack Obama. The Local Food System Toolkit, as rolled out by USDA, AMS, says Sarah Eckhouse, allows investors and governments to quantify the economic benefits Secretary Vilsack believes can revitalize rural economies.
In a lot of ways, I think it's actually more of a tool for businesses or investors or communities to use to make the case for these investments. It has a 7 modules that it walks you through in terms of the data that you need to collect and case studies, and it really kind of takes you step by step through the process to be able to create kind of an assessment of that impact that you want to have.
Again, the Local Food System Toolkit provides detailed guidance in 7 modules to measure and assess the expected economic impacts of local food investments. Those local food system investments aren't all targeted at producers or the people who raise the food. Some of it, says Sam Rickers, the administrator for USDA's Rural Business Cooperative Service, are aimed at the people in the middle of the supply chain.
Well, here's what we know. We know at USDA that if we ignore the viability of the retail outlets where folks are consuming these goods, then we're not creating that pipeline for the growers that we support through other programs to have markets for their goods.
This governmental focus is very much about creating economic activity by stimulating farmers to produce and retailers to sell. Again, here's Sarah Eckhouse from AMS.
Local food at this point is an over $12 billion business, and it's expected to increase to $20 billion by 2019. So there's a real demand there. And to get that food from many of the rural communities to the urban areas that have such a high demand for it, we need those middle of the supply chain aggregators, processors, distributors, and there are real economic job-creating opportunities there.
Opportunities USDA has been funding. In the last 6 years, USDA invested more than $800 million in more than 29,000 local and regional food businesses and infrastructure projects. Those dollars have funneled through both rural development, that's Sam Ricker's agency, and through AMS, that's where Sarah Eckhouse works. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.